All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Welcome to American Vindicta. Today we're going to talk about a very uncomfortable situation, should you ever find yourself in it. Looking back through history, siege warfare was one of the most horrific times of any population. Siege warfare was used in almost every single major engagement in every single major country in the entire history of the world. It is a way of warfare that is unsurpassed in the novels and sagas of the damage, the disease, and the stain upon that history. A siege warfare, by definition, is a military blockade of a city or a fortress with intent of conquering by attrition or a well-prepared assault. Siege warfare is a form of constant, low-intensity conflict characterized by one party holding a strong, static defensive position. Consequently, an opportunity for negotiation between combatants is common, as proximity and fluctuating advantage can encourage diplomacy. The art of conducting and resisting a siege is called siege warfare, or siege craft. A siege occurs when an attacker encounters this city, this fortress, that cannot be easily taken by a quick assault, which refuses to surrender to the incoming enemy. Sieges involve surrounding the target to block the routes of provision of supplies and the reinforcement or escape of troops, a tactic known as investment. This is typically coupled with attempts to reduce the fortifications by means of a siege engine or artillery bombardment, or mining, also known as sapping, or the use of deception or treachery to bypass the defenses. Failing a military outcome, sieges can often be decided by starvation, thirst, or disease, which can afflict either the attacker or defender. This form of siege, though, can take many months or even years, depending on the size of the stores of food the fortified position holds. The attacking force can circumvent the besieged palace or the castle or the town or the city, which it is to build a line of earthworks consisting of a rampart and a trench surrounding the encampment. During the process of circumvallation, the attacking force can be set up by another force, an ally of the besieged place, due to the lengthy amount of time that is required to force it to capitulate. A defensive ring of forts outside the ring of forts, called contravallation, is also sometimes used to defend the attackers from outside forces. Ancient cities in the Middle East show archaeological evidence of fortified city walls. During the Warring States era of ancient China, there is both textual and archaeological evidence of prolonged sieges and the siege machinery used against the defenders of the city walls. Siege machinery was also a tradition of the ancient Greco-Roman world. During the Renaissance and the early modern period, siege warfare dominated the conduct of war in Europe. Leonardo da Vinci gained as much of his renown from the design of fortifications as from his artwork. Medieval campaigns were generally designed around a succession of sieges. In the Napoleonic era, increasing use of ever more powerful cannons reduced the value of fortifications. In the 20th century, the significance of the classical siege was declined. With the advent of mobile warfare, a single fortified stronghold is no longer as decisive as it once was. While traditional sieges do still occur, they are not as common as they once were due to the changes in modes of battle, principally the ease by which volumes of destructive power can be directed onto a static target. Modern sieges are more commonly the result of smaller hostage, militant, or extreme resisting arrest situations. For example, one of the most well-known sieges actually occurred within probably the past 10 years. ISIS in Iraq had surrounded a group of people, a small, very unknown tribe to the modern world, and had forced through rocket-propelled attacks, artillery attacks, small arms attacks, also using larger, medium, and larger machine gun attacks. And they forced this town of people to eventually capitulate to their control. They starved them out. They waited them out. They were well provisioned as an attacker. And defensively, the town just was not up to par. Also, the town did not have much of terms of a defense force either. Now, ISIS also used U.S. American-made equipment to launch this attack. And our equipment, even in the hands of a terrorist state, is still extremely effective. I say these things as warning to you. And we're going to take a look back in history of the known accounts of sieges and what happened to the people in the Bible, what they were forced to do, what they chose to do, how they handled the situation. And where does that fall in line with you now? Was the lockdowns a form of a siege warfare? Are we now in a new state of siege warfare, where we can hold entire nations hostage through protocol, through requirements, and through laws? It's a new era. It's a new form of war, but it is still a very old one. Because still, the thing that was rampant in the wars then and the wars now was disease. The use of biological weapons has been around for thousands of years. We're going to explore part of that today. Stand by and take notes. We'll be right back.
Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum has said, "You will own nothing and you will love it." And that's represented by what's going on across the planet today, where the economy of the world is in free fall, and nowhere is it more in evidence than with our own President Biden deliberately trying to sabotage what we have, access to food, other resources. So Americans are in a unique position, really for the first time in our history. We're going to have to provide for ourselves or subject ourselves to the whim of the government. Do you really trust a government to feed you that left 1,000 Americans behind enemy lines in Afghanistan? I don't think so. So where do you go? When you ask the question, who's the best prepper out there today? There's only one answer. Ready Made Resources and Robert Griswold. I call him King Prepper, and that's how a lot of people think of him. You have everything there you'd want, from night vision to storable food, how to prepare cooking in emergency situations, books and videos on how to prepare alternative energy, communication, first aid that you wouldn't think of, natural antibiotics, you name it, Bob has it. Now, here's the good thing about Bob Griswold that no one else does but him. You don't have to buy anything to talk to him. If you're not sure where to start with your preparation, no obligation phone call directly to Bob. You can talk to him for free. Most people will charge you an arm and a leg for a half-hour conversation. That's not Bob Griswold. He cares about helping America get prepared. Go to readymaderesources.com, or you can call the number directly at 800-627-3809. Again, that contact information, readymaderesources.com, for the best prepping outfit in the country, or call Bob Griswold directly, 800-627-3809.
All right, welcome back. Right now I have 25 Bible verses about siege warfare. We're going to go over this so that we can give a little bit of weight to the calamity that is siege warfare. And I want you to understand that the Bible has a tremendous amount of history of this style of warfare. And right now, if we continue to play our cards wrong, America will be encircled, and we will be in a siege war against our enemies. We already have those that are domestically within that are part of the agents of siege warfare. Even Sun Tzu talked about this. I believe this is the rate that we're going. It seems like the right kind of warfare. An out-and-out kinetic warfare doesn't really prove well for anybody. But if you shut off the lights, turn off the water, let the disease and the violence burn out of control, America will burn itself out of existence. It's a hell of a thing to think of. So, let's get started. Deuteronomy 20:12. However, if it does not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. Judges 9:50. Then Abimelech went to Thebes, and he camped against Thebes and captured it. 1 Samuel 11:1. Now Naash the Ammonite came up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead, and all the men of Jabesh said to Naash, "Make a covenant with us, and we will serve you." That is called capitulation. 2 Samuel 11:1. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when the kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. 2 Samuel 20:15. They came and besieged him in Abel Beth Maach, and they cast up a siege ramp against the city, and it stood by the rampart, and all the people who were with Joab were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. 1 Kings 20:1. Now Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, gathered all his army, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots. He went up and besieged Samaria and fought against it. We're going to come back to this verse. 1 Kings 20:15-20. Then he mustered the young men of the rulers of the provinces, and there were 232. And after them he mustered all the people, even all the sons of Israel, which were 7,000. They went out at noon, when Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in the temporary shelters with the 32 kings who helped him. The young men of the rulers of the provinces went out first, and Ben-Hadad sent out, and they told him, saying, men have come out from Samaria. 2 Kings 6:24. Now it came about after this that Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, gathered all his army and went up and besieged Samaria. 2 Kings 7:3-7. Now there were four leprous men at the entrance of the gate, and they said one to another, why do we sit here until we die? If we say, we will enter the city, then the famine is in the city, and we will die there. And if we sit here, we die also. Now therefore come, and let us go over to the camp of the Arameans. If they spare us, we will live. If they kill us, we will but die. They arose at twilight to go to the camp of the Arameans. When they came to the outskirts of the camp, the Arameans, behold, there was no one there. 2 Kings 17:5-6. Then the king of Assyria invaded the whole land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hosea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and carried Israel away into exile to Assyria, and settled them in Halah and Habor, on the river of Gozan, in the cities of the Medes. 2 Kings 18:9-12. Now in the 4th year of King Hezekiah, which was the 7th year of Hosea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. At the end of 3 years, they captured it. In the 6th year of Hezekiah, which was the 9th year of Hosea, king of Israel, Samaria was captured. Then the king of Assyria carried Israel away into exile to Assyria and put them in Halah on the Habor, the river of Gozan. So we have a lot so far just within Kings of siege warfare. Here, last one. 2 Kings 18:17. Then the king of Assyria sent Tartan, the Rabsaris, and Rabshaka from Lachish, king of Hezekiah, with a large army to Jerusalem. So they went up and came to Jerusalem. And when they went up, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is on the highway of the Fuller's Field. That means that they are now going to cut off the water. 2 Chronicles 32:1-5. After these acts of faithfulness, the king of Assyria came and invaded Judah and besieged the fortified cities, and thought to break into them for himself. Now when Hezekiah saw that the king had come and sent, he intended to make war on Jerusalem, he decided with his officers and his warriors to cut off the supply of water from the springs which were outside the city, and they helped him. Isaiah 29:5-8. But the multitude of your enemies will become like fine dust, and the multitude of the ruthless ones like the chaff which blows away. And it will happen instantly, suddenly. From the Lord of hosts you will be punished with thunder and earthquake and loud noise, with whirlwind and tempest and the flame of a consuming fire, and the multitude of all nations who wage war against Ariel, even all who wage war against her and her stronghold, who distress her, will be like a dream, a vision of night. Imagine the whole world coming to wage war against one place. Isaiah 37:36-37. Then the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men arose early in the morning, behold, all of these were dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived in Nineveh. 2 Kings 25:1. Now in the 9th year of his reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came. he and all his army against Jerusalem, camped against it, and built a siege wall all around it. When you hear the word camped against a city, that is the encirclement of the forces around a city, which means the forces of the attacking army surround a city or a fortress. You cut off all lanes of travel, so the highways, the streams. You would cut off any navigable waterways to the ocean or to a lake. Even to the extent that you have to, they would cut down entire droves of trees for clear lines of sight. Let's continue. So the city was under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. On the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. Then the city was broken into, and all the men of war fled by night by way of the gate between the two walls beside the king's garden, though the Chaldeans were all around the city. So, imagine being so severely stricken with disease, famine, thirst. You can no longer put up walls that have been torn down. You can no longer stand on those walls to defend them. You can't repel the attacks anymore. You just wait for the inevitable. And that's why the men fled. Even knowing that the enemy was outside the gates, they still fled. Jeremiah 39, 1 through 10. Now when Jerusalem was captured in the 9th year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came to Jerusalem and laid siege against it. In the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the 4th month, in the 9th day of the month, the city wall was breached. Then all the officials of the king of Babylon came in and sat down at the middle gate. Second Chronicles 36, verses 17 through 20. Therefore he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary. And he had no compassion on a young man or virgin or old man or infirm. He gave them all into his hand. All the articles of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his officers, he brought them all to Babylon. Then they burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burned all its fortified buildings with fire and destroyed all its valuable articles. Here's a good example. America, if we do not get down on our knees as a people, we will be besieged. That is the inevitable history of the Bible, and it is still played out today. We may live in a modern war with modern conveniences, but we still fight like, primitives. We still do the absolute most worst things in war. If you look at the warfare that's happening right now in Ukraine, Russia has besieged Ukraine. They choose to use artillery fire from tanks, mobile artillery platforms, rocket fire, and they wait out that city. And as the ordnances drop, as the rockets slam into one building after the other, the civilian population is torn asunder by shrapnel, by the fire, the explosive force, buildings collapsing on top of people, on top of shelters, stores that had goods and provisions destroyed. That is the new warfare. Think about that. We always joke that if America was ever to be engaged in warfare on the home soil, that it would be a civil war, or that it would be a red dawn. And many fantastical movies and great conversations are made out of this idea, this hypothetical situation. But very rarely does anybody take the time to look at the historical context of such a situation. I believe as Christians we need to learn warfare the way that God has taught us. This also has to do with your preparation. Why do you think all these besiegements in the Bible were recorded? Was it for days such as this? When you start to read the witness testimony of how far people will go to feed themselves during a siege, and just how quickly the system breaks down. Hopefully it would make even the most careless of you listening pay a little more attention. Now, I don't mean to be rude or negative or call anybody out, but this does have to do with the preparedness mindset. As Christians, we are called to be prepared. Everybody is prepared for Donald Trump to come back. Everybody is prepared for the Lord to come back, as you should be. Just please understand that many things can happen between now and the inevitable salvation. Be prepared. Luke 19, verse 43, "For the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must not enter the city, because these are the days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled." Every wrath comes from God. He uses weather as an instrument, and he uses man as an instrument. But these wraths come from God to a corrupt people as punishment for sins, as punishment for ways that they do not turn. And you know who gets caught up in all of them? Everyone involved. Do you not think, even though you may be a Christian, and we do believe that God provides for us all, but do you not think ever that you could run out of water? That your crops may be set on fire? That your neighbors could be forced to stealing, breaking and entering, causing death within the halls of your own home? These things have happened. These things will happen. Deuteronomy 28, verses 51 through 57. "Moreover, it shall eat the offspring of your herd and the produce of your ground until you are destroyed. Who also leaves you no grain, new wine, or oil, nor the increase of your herd or the young of your flock until they have caused you to perish. It shall besiege you and all your towns until you are high, and fortified walls in which you trusted come down throughout your land, and it shall besiege you in all your towns throughout your land, which the Lord your God has given you. Then you shall eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your own sons and of your daughters, whom the Lord your God has given you, during the siege and the distress by which your enemies will oppress you. Now, children of God, we may be subject to the same thing. And you may disagree with me on that, but history does not. History proves that even for those who were well fortified, even for those who were well prepared, still suffered alongside the unprepared. For when you start to take people in, everything that you had saved up, stored up, now becomes limited. This is why the Bible teaches us to have faith. It was one small boy who was sent out by his mother with fish and bread that was able to multiply it for the masses. 1 ounce of faith can go a very far, far length. So don't think the miracles can't happen, which is another part of the besiege. It is to cause depression, the oppression from the oppressors. It's not just a physical siege, but a spiritual one. Imagine how many times you may walk the streets during a siege. Like many times in World War II. And every time you go out, those calories spent, and you don't find food, those calories not returned to you, you get a little more tired. You get a little more fatigued. You see your family losing weight. Do not think that this cannot affect you. And this is just my own, example here. But there were Christians in Germany and in Russia and in Poland who were all oppressed and besieged, who starved, some starved to death, who were afflicted by disease. Just because we're children of God, does that mean that we walk around with a force field over us? There is a reality here that breaks people's spirits whenever they see these things happen. Which is why we should have a strong sense of God being in the middle of our life as our foundation. For just think, for those who are firmly rooted in God to become depressed when they see the atrocities happening to their people, to their own household. What about the newcomers to the faith? What about those who have already been shaken in their faith prior to whatever type of horrible situation? It will be up to you, rooted firmly in your faith, to pull that congregation of people together in prayer, praying for one another. That is how we resist. Because if you don't control that, and you have to control that. If you don't control it, then there will be infighting, stealing, backbiting. The rumor mill will begin to churn out all new types of lies. Distrust will grow. And one of the worst diseases that I have seen is the disease of distrust, of paranoia, of fear. This is why we should have God at the center of our life. but this is also why you should be prepared. This is why I harp on the community. Even if you live in a big town, your suburb, your street, your family. It doesn't take much to walk around and to ask neighbors, hey, we're having a meeting. If XYZ were to happen, should we prepare for it? And how could we? How could we provide for one another? What is everybody's skill sets? And if they don't want to be involved, then they're not involved. But just understand, the more prepared you are now, the more prepared you will be later. The less prepared you are now, the more hellish it will be later. Second Kings chapter 6, verses 24 through 29. Now it came about after this that Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, gathered all his army and went up and besieged Samaria. There was a great famine in Samaria, and behold, they besieged it, until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver, and a fourth of a kebab of dove's dung for 5 shekels of silver. As the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, he heard a woman cry out, "Oh, help me, my lord, O king." I want to read to you an example of the dystopian-like madness that can happen. And if it can happen in God's own chosen people as a punishment to the people, America, you are nothing special. It can happen to us as well. The king said, "If the Lord will not help you, how shall I help you? From the threshing floor or from the winepress?" And the king asked her, "What is your trouble?" She answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.' So we boiled my son and ate him. And on the next day I said to her, 'Give your son, that way we may eat him.' But she has hidden her son." When the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes, rent his clothes. Just understand this. Could you imagine modern day Christians with the talk of cannibalism coming out of New York Times as, you know, being something that, you know, shouldn't be taboo? I remember when there was a famous singer, she was talking about, Katy Perry, she was talking about her experiences with cannibalism and how it tasted like pork, like a fine pork. And while she was in France, I believe it was Paris, that she went to a very discreet diner where they actually even fed human meat to people. Supposedly, these were people that were, bought, their bodies were purchased upon the day of death. If that is true, I heard her say it. She was on a radio show, and she was in the studio when she said it. Maybe you can find it on YouTube. I doubt it's there anymore. But when I heard this woman say this, and she comes from, you know, her father, I believe, is a pastor, I just thought about the madness of the world and just how maddening a besieged city could be. Think of all you in New York. Think of all the resources that your city does not have. If I encircled New York, I cut off the bridges, I put my ships along the Delaware, I cut off your harbor, what do you have? I'll tell you what you have. The most precious resource you will have is time. Because to those who are not of privilege, your time will probably be cut in half compared to them. The privileged prep. Do not think the rich are not wealthy and prepared. They are. Of course, they have the money to. Many of us don't. So we rely upon each other and upon our own services and upon the government, which fails us consistently. You have nothing but time. And me, as the attacking force, I can go out and I can get my own provisions. I can even set up farming if I need to and sit there for a couple winters and summers. I can scourge the land for every resource that I need, waiting for the day that after you have completed your MREs, your meals ready to eat, after you've torn apart your Walmart and your gas stations, after you've gone through the warehouses and the restaurants, I'll wait until you can no longer stomach eating each other. And then I will be welcomed in as a hero. That is a scary history of a siege warfare. Now, you got to understand something, that for every physical problem, there's not always a physical solution. And there may not be very many physical problems with spiritual solutions. Some people are just going to suffer. Some people are just going to lose their mind. But those of you firmly rooted with Christ in the center of your being, understand that God has conquered the world. Everything is being done to magnify Him. Everything is being done and controlled by Him. Sometimes that's hard to stomach. Such is the ugly side of war. When's the last time your pastor even dared talk about this? This is why preparedness as a community means so much. I was just telling my wife earlier today, I was out walking. Tried to walk for as long as possible in 100 degree weather. And I stopped along the church that's not far from us. And I just sat there and I thought, you know, what would be really nice is if they just had a water pump out here so that I could obtain my own water if need be. And immediately I started thinking, well, I mean, you could, but if you were also evil, you could take something that is tainted and put down that pipe to poison the water well. Immediately my mind goes to that. And then immediately my mind goes to, well, we'll probably have to take the water pump and put it in a secured, controlled area. And you know that churches are not staffed 24/7 with people waiting for you to get water. So now we have that problem. But if I had a church, I would want to be able to have the well for my people. You know, when's the last time you went to a church that had a farm or crops set up to feed its own people or the community? That's not in anybody's mindset anymore, because you have grocery stores. If you look at a couple of the countries right now, hell, let's just think about what happened in Venezuela. 2 days after power, your food starts to rot. Chicken goes bad. The meat goes bad. No misting water to be put on all the vegetables to keep them fresh. No air conditioning to keep everything nice and cool. The milk goes bad. The cheese goes bad. Everything in the frozen aisle section starts to thaw. So the rush for the pharmacies, the rush for the food that is there that's being kept cool, you don't think that's where violence doesn't occur? It does. It occurs right there. That's where the madness occurs. You know, throw another thing in there. No ability to pay for anything. Just recently, I can't remember which country it was, but they had lost power in their country, and people were complaining while they were at the grocery store. Not only was the grocery store almost out of everything, but then the power went out, and what precious items the people had, they couldn't pay for with their credit cards or their Apple Watch or their phone. Very few people even had cash. Oh, by the way, just a reminder, we are going to a cashless society. Let's talk about 7 of the most brutal sieges in history. This is coming from thehistory.com, wrote by Evan Andrews. Right off the bat, one of the first recorded military engagements in history, the Battle of Megiddo, also resulted in a grueling, months-long siege. The standoff came in the 15th century BC when the Egyptian pharaoh, Thutmose III, led his forces into modern-day Palestine to quell a rebellion by a coalition of Mesopotamian city-states. According to Egyptian military histories, the two armies faced each other outside the city of Megiddo in a bloody clash of infantrymen and charioteers, with the pharaoh himself supposedly fighting on the front lines. But while the Egyptians routed the coalition forces, they wasted time looting an enemy encampment and allowed the Asiatic army to fall back to the safety of the city's fortifications. Undeterred by this, the pharaoh Thutmose set up a siege line and cut off all traffic in and out of the city. The stranglehold lasted for 7 brutal months until finally, reeling from starvation and disease, the town's leaders sent out their young sons and daughters to beg for peace. Having pacified the surrounding region, Thutmose spared Megiddo in exchange for a vow of loyalty from the city's survivors. 7 brutal months. How much food do you have? Is there a reason why the government says to have 2 weeks of food, 6 months worth of food, 2 years worth of food if you can manage that? Probably. Number 2 on our list, the Siege of Vicksburg. Along with the Battle of Gettysburg, the Siege of Vicksburg stands as one of the major turning points in the Civil War. The deadlock began in May 1863 when Union General Ulysses S. Grant trapped Confederate forces under John C. Pemberton within the town of Vicksburg, Mississippi. After probing the Confederate lines in a pair of unsuccessful assaults, Grant reluctantly ordered his men to dig trenches and lay siege to the city. Desperate to avoid the carnage, many of the citizen civilians were forced to take refuge in a network of clay caves that became known as the Prairie Dog Village. In an effort to break the standoff, Grant's forces eventually dug a tunnel and detonated mines under the city's fortifications. While the outnumbered Southerners managed to hold their lines and seal the breach, their victory proved short-lived. Without reinforcements and with only meager supplies, Pemberton finally capitulated on July 4th. With the fall of Vicksburg, Union forces took full control of the Mississippi River, effectively splitting the Confederacy in half for the rest of the war. Number 3, the Siege of Tyre. In 332 BC, the famed Greek conqueror Alexander the Great set his sights on the ancient city of Tyre, a Mediterranean island located a half mile off the coast of Lebanon. While Alexander's 35,000-strong army dwarfed the Tyrian military, the city had a strong navy and enough supplies to weather a long standoff. More importantly, the island boasted fortified walls that supposedly stood 150 feet high. Unable to get close enough to take the city by traditional means, the Greeks chose to lay siege to the island. In one of history's most audacious examples of military engineering, Alexander then ordered his men to use timber and stone to build a causeway connecting the island to the mainland. Once this artificial land bridge had gotten close enough to Tyre, his men were able to set up a siege engine and bombard the city walls. After a seven-month standoff, the Greek forces finally breached the fortifications and took the island in a brutal onslaught. Amazingly, Alexander's makeshift causeway later collected sand and silt, permanently changing the island of Tyre into a peninsula. Number 4. The Siege of Candia. This two-decade siege began in the 17th century when a band of the Knights of Malta raided a fleet of Ottoman ships and fled to the Venetian-controlled city of Candia, located on the island of Crete. The Venetians and the Ottomans were already locked in a precarious political situation, and the robbery provided the spark for an all-out war. By 1645, an army of 60,000 Turks had landed on Crete and began ravaging the countryside. After conquering most of the island, the Ottomans descended on the metropolis of Candia in 1648 and set up an elaborate network of siege lines. Despite launching repeated assaults and bombardments, the Turks were unable to strike a decisive blow. The citizens of Candia, many of whom spent their whole lives under the blockade, always managed to drive back the Ottoman army and seal the breach before their fortress could be compromised. A French fleet arrived in 1669 to reinforce the city and help lift the siege, but quickly withdrew after its flagship was destroyed in battle. With Candia in ruins and only a few thousand troops left, the defenders finally surrendered shortly thereafter. By the time the blockade lifted in September 1669, the city had been under siege for an astonishing 21 years and 4 months. Number 5, the Siege of Carthage. This grisly standoff came as part of the Third Punic War, with last in a series of notoriously violent clashes between the ancient Romans and the Phoenician city of Carthage. In 149 BC, a Roman army led by Scipio Amelianus arrived in North Africa intent on destroying Carthage once and for all. Met by 60-foot walls, the Roman cordoned off the city and set up a camp and lay sieged. The Carthaginians had prepared for the invasion by turning most of their city into an armory and enlisting slaves and civilians into the military. According to the ancient historian Appian, the women of Carthage even cut off their hair so it could be used as rope for makeshift catapults. Faced with this level of resistance, the Romans were held at bay for 3 long years. When they finally breached the walls in 146 BC, Scipio's forces had to fight their way through the city streets for 6 days and nights before defeating the Carthaginian resistance. By the time the battle had ended, the 700-year-old city of Carthage lay in ruins, and its remaining 50,000 inhabitants had been sold into slavery. Number 6, the Siege of Leningrad. World War II's Siege of Leningrad stands as a chilling reminder of the toll a military blockade can take on a civilian population. German forces first reached the city in 1941 as part of Operation Barbarossa, a massive surprise attack on the Soviet Union. Eager to avoid the carnage of urban warfare, the Nazis made no serious attempts to take Leningrad by force. Instead, Adolf Hitler opted for a brutal alternative, laying siege and starving the city into submission. The 3 million inhabitants of Leningrad had been caught unprepared and lacked sufficient supplies for a prolonged standoff. In addition to daily bombardments by the Luftwaffe, they were soon forced to contend with the extreme hunger, freezing temperatures, and rampant disease. People ate everything from wallpaper paste to shoe leather to supplement their meager bread rations, and some even resorted to cannibalism. Despite these horrific circumstances, the citizens of Leningrad managed to endure life under siege for 872 days from September 1941 until January 1944. Even in victory, the siege proved tragic. By the time the city was finally freed by the Red Army, an estimated 1 million Soviets, most of them civilians, had perished. Number 7, the Great Siege of Gibraltar. At the time that it was embroiled in combat with American colonists during the Revolutionary War, Great Britain was also locked in one of the great sieges in European history. The standoff began in 1779 after Spain and France officially entered the revolution on the side of the Continentals. Eager to strike a blow against England, the two nations soon joined forces in an attempt to reclaim Gibraltar, a small rocky outcropping on the Iberian Peninsula that played a key role in British naval operations in the Mediterranean. In June 1779, a fleet of French and Spanish ships blockaded Gibraltar from the sea, while a large infantry force constructed redoubts and other fortifications on land. The two nations hoped they could force Gibraltar's small garrison of 5,000 troops into a war of attrition, but their siege lines ultimately proved no match for the British Navy, which ran the blockade twice, first in 1780, and then again in 1781. In between these vital resupply operations, the defenders of Gibraltar kept the besiegers at bay with sharpshooters, cannon fire, and surprise nighttime attacks. Realizing they could not starve out the garrison, the French and Spanish launched a massive offensive in September 1782, only to be thwarted by the British artillery's use of red hot shot, heated cannonballs that set fire to whole ships and batteries. Defeated, the French and Spanish finally lifted their blockade in February 1783. By that time, the British forces on Gibraltar had been under siege for 3 years and 7 months. If you've noticed so far, a siege can last for years. Typically does. How many of our allies would come to our aid? and what could potentially push our allies away to the point that they did not want to be in a contested war, a blockade. America does blockades all the time. We did one to Iran. We've done one to Iraq. America has, let's just say it like this, we have it coming to us. And no one in this country will be spared. Not the rich, not the poor, not the saved, not the sinner. Siege warfare is equally horrific for the population. I have questions, though, in my own mind when I start to read about 2 Kings and Ben-Hadad. When you read about people so willing to eat their own children. The Book of Lamentations. What a horrific, horrific book to read. When Jeremiah wrote the Book of Lamentations, some of the lessons that are in that book, they talk about the suffering and our need to bring our suffering, our anger, our pain, and confusion to God, lamenting about our sin and the horrible things that come from it. Remember, sin equals death. So, let's finish with this. How does a person become so mentally stricken with depravity that their only option for a meal is the flesh of their own child? I can't get my mind around that. How does a mother staring at their child, examining the meal to come, determine the best way to cook their child? That is a special kind of evil that deserves a special kind of torment. But that is from my flesh. The sad fact of the matter is, war does this. Judgment does this. Why didn't the mothers who were starving cry out to God? Why didn't they give up and surrender to Ben-Hadad? Why were they not properly prepared for at least a few weeks' worth of food to that extent? And finally, was the ability to commit cannibalism of their own children in their hearts already? Or was this horrific act from battle shock and the emotional trauma caused by siege warfare? To kill in self-defense is understandable. To kill in war is understandable. To kill a man breaking into your home is understandable. His blood is on his own hands. But to commit murder, to sate your hunger, is an inhuman act that is led by a corrupt heart and a mind full of sin and desperate people. I do not even understand how these thoughts could come into any minds of any parents. Yet, we are given almost weekly examples of parents brutally killing their children in this country, and I'm not talking about the murder act called abortion. Over the past series of weeks, I have seen report after report of parents killing their children. In Indiana, a 22-year-old man is sentenced to 4 life sentences for killing his girlfriend and her 3 children. Their ages were 5, 3, and 2. This is all happening now, before the calamity is to come. Imagine what it will be when they get here. When looking at these sieges, I have to ask myself, where was the need to plan for the extreme scenarios that will probably never happen? And as a Christian, when I try to push this warning out to others, where is your need to plan for the extreme scenario that may never happen? People don't want to divert resources to it. People tell me all the time they can't. I have this reason, I have that reason. Or I don't believe this is that big of a deal. You know what? Everything will just go back to normal. Everything will be okay. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it doesn't go back to normal. Sometimes it gets worse. It gets worse because as the judgments fall upon our heads, our sin has gotten worse. That, to me, is part of the birth pangs. The drought, the famine, the disease, the war, the rumors of wars, the corruption in the government, the corruption in our laws, the inequities in our laws. Why didn't the government help? When Ben-Hadad had laid siege on Samaria and the king was talking to the women who were eating their children, why didn't the king provide for them? Why didn't the king give food to his people? Where was the storage of rations from the neighbors who felt that it was God's will to supply others food, even to those who did not prepare? During the siege, we are not given any testimony of the sharing of grain or butter or oil or produce, milk, or sources of protein from animals. Instead, the king is confronted by two women who argue over the act of cannibalism of one of their own children, yet the other mother ate this mother's son and the next day refused to give in to that temptation. And hid her child. The little boy with the bread and fish came prepared, and with one person's meal, God fed an entire crowd of thousands. So, even if you are only able to prepare a little, God can turn that into much, much more. Little is much when God is in it. This has been today's history lesson. Enjoy your week. It's American Vindicta. Stay frosty. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.